dangerous for disappointment of missing a great ACB radio program? Join our announcements list today. Receive email about upcoming programs on all our channels and new features. To join, send a blank email now to announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
That's announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
Or visit our website. Announcements about ACB Radio delivered to you direct and free. Just another way to stay in touch with ACB Radio.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradionewsroom.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.
ACB.
And welcome to Blind Line. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and this is the original international interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. Good to have you along, and for those of you who are listening to the program live, apologies for the delay in the beginning of this program. They say the best things in life are worth waiting for, don't they? And we had a server move over the weekend, and just discovered as we were going to air that the server that we use to bring you Blind Line did not come up in the reboot. There you go. That's what happens with Linux, you see. When you only reboot every 200 and something days, and only then because you've had to move the thing, well, anything can happen, and probably will, when you reboot. But nevertheless, let us get on with it, because we've got an interesting program today, talking about libraries of the future that are becoming a reality today. And we'll be speaking about the electronic library and the various services that are offered by the CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. Many of you will have seen the news story and heard about the discussion on various blindness lists, read that discussion, which heralded the awarding of a gold medal, the Lewis Braille Medal, by the World Blind Union, jointly with the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, to Bill Gates for the work that he had done in advancing technology for blind people. And in particular, he's, through Microsoft, of course, been involved in sponsoring the library program in Canada, the electronic services that they offer, including VisuText, VisuNews, and the very exciting new portal for children. We're going to be talking in depth to Jerry Chevalier from the CNIB about that, and we'll do that in just a second. But somebody who really did steal the show at the gala event that marked the presentation of the awarding of this medal was Timothy Peters, who's 10, and he showed Bill Gates around this portal and showed him what it could do. And earlier yesterday, I caught up with Timothy to have a chat to him for Blind.
Timothy, welcome to the program, and first let's talk a little bit about you. You're 10, is that right?
Yeah.
And what technology do you use at school?
I use a computer, a Braille and Speak, and a Brailler.
And what computer software are you running? What screen reader do you use?
Well, at home I use JAWS, but on the school computer for my computer subject, they don't have JAWS on that computer, so I use Teletalk there.
Well, does that get confusing, having two different programs that you have to learn?
Yeah.
Because you hit one key and you think it's going to do something because you're so used to what you're using at home, and then you find it does something else.
Yeah.
That's annoying.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, and do you use the internet at home?
Yeah. With the help of my dad, I do.
Okay, that sounds like a good idea. Because we're broadcasting on the internet right now on ACB Radio, which is the radio station for blind people around the world.
Cool.
Yeah, it is. Now, what's your favorite subjects at school?
Well, I like language. That's a very good one. And I also like French.
Okay. So you would speak... Do you speak French as fluently as you speak English?
I think so.
Right. Okay. Because everybody in Canada would learn English and French, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, because they're the two official languages.
Right.
And how does the... Because I know we're going to talk about you meeting Bill Gates soon, and that must have been exciting, but I guess that came up because you're using the services of the CNIB and their library. Yeah. What kind of services do they offer you?
Well, they offer me reading services and information services for school projects.
Okay, well, how does that work?
Well, I call the CNIB and I ask for the IRC, which is the Information Resource Center.
Okay.
And I ask for the information resource I want, and they send it to me in the mail.
Very good. So what kind of thing might an information resource be that they would get for you? Can you give me an example of the kind of thing you might ask them for?
Okay. Like, once I ask for information on Louis Braille.
Oh, okay.
From the Information Resource Center. And I got it.
So they would do all sorts of research for you, and they would send you... What do they send it to you in? Do you get that in Braille or on disk, or how does it work?
I get it in alternate formats, whatever format I want.
Cool. What do you prefer? What's your ideal format most of the time?
Braille.
Yeah. But I hear from reading all the stuff they send me about you that you're also a pretty big talking book user.
Yeah, but sometimes they put me to sleep.
Because sometimes if you use talking books too much, then your Braille skills might go a bit rusty, I suppose.
Yeah.
How much Braille do you read generally?
Well, I think one book a week.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you use any of the services? I was having a look yesterday at what you can do on the internet with the CNIB, and they've got a special section for children and all kinds of things where you can look at newspapers and do searches. Do you use any of that?
Not regularly.
Right. But it's probably something you'll pick up as you get on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Bill Gates, now this must have been pretty exciting stuff, catching up with him. Yeah. What's he like?
Well, he's pretty nice.
Yeah. Because he's a pretty clever and very rich man, of course. Did he have lots of people with him looking after him, or was he just there on his own?
Well, he was at the thing on his own, but I'm not sure about the time.
And so, what were you there to show him?
The new website that they're making called the Children's Discovery Portal that I happen to be senior beta tester for.
Very good. What can you do on the Children's Discovery Portal?
You can go to the library, the chat room, you can look at the homepage, and play games on it. But it's not up and running quite yet.
Okay, they're still working on it. When do you know when they're hoping to have that going?
About next year.
Right. Must be a big thing then. You know, they're taking a lot of time to get it right.
Yeah.
Now, the chat room, is that just a voice chat, or is it a text chat?
Like kids chatting with a voice program telling you what they're saying.
Yes, I see, yep. So it's not one of those ones where you can speak to somebody and you can hear their voice coming back?
No.
Yeah, okay. And so you would use JAWS for that at home?
Well, for the rest of the website, yes, but the chat room has its own program.
I see, so it's self-voicing.
Yeah.
That is pretty impressive. And is the speech good for that? Like, it nice and intelligible, understandable?
Yes.
And it would be bilingual again, wouldn't it? It would be able to do French as well as English?
I think so.
One of the things, if you're going to be a really successful student these days and you've got people with access to all sorts of internet resources with their mums and dads at home, to have a facility where you can find a whole lot of accessible ways to get information must really make your schoolwork a whole lot easier.
Yeah, it certainly does.
What do you want to do when you leave school? Have you thought about that? What kind of career you might like to have?
Well, I'd like to work a bit at the CNIB, and I think maybe I'd also be a waiter at Swiss Chalet.
Wow, that's an interesting mix. So what kind of thing at the CNIB do you think you might like to do? Like, are you really into computers? Would you like to have a career in the computer area?
No, reading books into talking book format would be one of my cups of tea.
Now that is interesting. I've actually done a little bit of that reading for our library here in New Zealand. But of course, first of all, you've got to have the material in Braille before it's possible. Are you a pretty fast Braille reader then?
Yeah.
So, what did Bill Gates say anything exciting to you? He didn't spill any beans about the next version of Windows or anything like that that you can give us the scoop on?
No, nothing real juicy like that.
Oh, bother. What did he think? Because he got a medal, I understand. That was the whole purpose. Microsoft has been sponsoring this CNIB program, and he got a medal for in association with the World Blind Union for all of this. But what was his impression of it? Did he seem impressed with it?
Yeah. He thought it was really cool, and he was glad to have me on the team.
Very good. So you didn't think you might like to work for Microsoft then?
No, he didn't ask me that.
Oh, well, it's only a matter of time, I'm sure. Oh, that's good. So, well, I really appreciate you having a chat. And we're actually going to talk in a second to Jerry Chevalier from the library a little more about how it is going from their end. But it's really great to speak with you, and I thank you for giving up some time.
Okay, thanks.
There you go, that's Timothy Peters, and he was the man, 10 years old, and he spoke to Bill Gates and showed him all around, played some games with him, according to a newspaper article I was reading, and showed him how to download all sorts of books. I was reading some amazing figures about how the library at the CNIB is going to end up with a database. I think they said something like 9 terabytes of disk space. And when you get into those sorts of numbers, it's like when people talk about billions of dollars, isn't it? It just becomes almost like a blur, incalculable numbers. So it's 9 terabytes of disk space or something like that. And I'm sure if I've got that wrong, we'll be corrected, because joining me right now is Jerry Chevalier, who's the director. Is that the title, Jerry, you call the director of the library?
Oh, no, I'm not as prestigious as that. I'm just a lowly volunteer chairing the board of directors.
Ah, yes, I know the feeling. He's very good. It's nice to have you on the program, and you must be very proud of how this library is shaping up.
Oh, I'm very excited about it, yeah. In fact, the reason I joined the library as a volunteer, I guess about 4 years ago, is I could see as a client and a user how things were starting to shape up and change, and I thought there must be some very clever and very talented systems types people in the background, and myself being a software developer and systems person, I thought I want to know a little bit more about this, so I didn't quite know I was going to get as involved as I did and have as much work to do, but it's been a real thrill to be involved with the whole process.
How does the CNIB structure work? Because you've got a separate board for the library, presumably is that accountable in some way to the main board of the CNIB?
It is indeed. It's actually a board of management, an advisory board to the legal authority of CNIB, which would be the National Board of Directors. In Canada, CNIB, much like RNIB, is a rehab agency, and so it provides rehab services across the country through 9 geographic divisions and 1 national library division. So, in fact, the library is wholly owned by CNIB. And the policy development is looked after by the Board of Management for the CNIB Library Division, which in turn reports to the National Board, and we get our funding, most of our funding for the Library Division, from the big CNIB.
And the CNIB, in terms of accessible formats, is pretty much the only game in town in Canada, is that right?
Well, yeah, I guess I have to be a little bit embarrassed as a Canadian we have to acknowledge that among the G7 countries, Canada is really the only one that has no publicly funded national library service, free library service for people who can't read print. In Canada, the closest thing, the only national library service we have is the CNIB, and it's a wholly owned and a private charity rather than a publicly mandated service. So we could do a lot better in Canada, and we keep bothering our federal government and the provincial regional library governments about what they could do better.
And New Zealand's in the same position with not a cent for library services, although like you, there is the postal concession that's available, but they even tried to take that away from us at one point. What is the rationale that the government uses for not fully funding a national library service for the blind in the way that other G8 countries do?
Well, I think if we knew that, I'm not really sure. Somebody said facetiously one time that Colonel Baker, who was the founder of the CNIB and a war-blinded veteran from World War I, who started the Library for the Blind in Canada with his own personal Braille collection, they said, and then he later gave it to the CNIB, and that's what started the CNIB library. They said perhaps if he would have given it to the federal government, we'd have a national library service run by the federal government. But it seems that CNIB got started so early in the game and did such a good job that the public libraries across the country, both at the provincial government level and at the federal level, just never really got in the game. And that's a premise that nobody can prove, but it seems to be that they just don't have library services for the blind top of mind. I think it's slowly beginning to change because we've identified through Stats Canada studies that there's probably some 3 million print disabled in Canada, which is about 10% of our population. We're around 30 million here. And about 1 million of those are print disabled by way of significant visual impairment, and the rest would be physical or perceptual disabilities like learning disabilities or dyslexia. So fully 10% of the population is in need of some sort of alternate format free library service, and the governments have to start thinking about getting their heads around that. There was a national task force struck a couple of years ago by the National Library of Canada, which is the federally funded national library, and they identified a need to do just that, to put money into production at the national level and to encourage distribution and partnerships with public libraries and publishers right across the country. So I think we're slowly getting there, but it's been a long time coming.
Yes, and it's very frustrating when these things tend to be an accident of social policy history, really, rather than any coherent policy framework that makes sure that people who are deserving of assistance get it. But I suppose that, like a number of blindness agencies around the world, you guys probably have a problem in that you're reasonably well off. People give generously to blindness organizations, and there are other disability groups saying, well, don't give more government money to them because we're not as well supported as the CNIB is.
Well, yeah, but you know, Jonathan, the solution, in my view, is not to give the CNIB more money, because at the end of the day, we have about 100,000 clients nationwide. And so that figure identified of 3 million people, that means we only have a target client base that's about 3% of that population. And even among the visually impaired, we're only serving about 10% of people who have significant visual impairments, because not everybody is ready to join a rehab agency and name themselves as a client, especially when 80% of our clients are over the age of 60. These are people that are losing their vision in later stages of life, and they don't just necessarily run down the street to join up with the CNIB. So the solution really at the public level, at the federal and provincial government level, I think, is to partner with us and to form a nationwide distribution network, I think, of which CNIB would be a major component. But I don't see it necessarily true that we should become the only game in town. We are now, But there should be a nationwide partnership of all organizations involved in information distribution, and that would be the challenge to form in this country.
So you don't see the possibility that the government may simply take over the running of the library service and leave the CNIB to what could be described as its core business of rehab?
Well, that's a possibility, but I wouldn't advocate it because the fully publicly funded model has some problems as well. You'll see the situation in the United States with NLS being a totally funded library service through the Library of Congress. They're probably not able to move quite as fast as we are in terms of bringing about changes to the way service is delivered and some of the new digital services that we're talking about. We're going to move on this in a space. We've been working on it for about 2 to 3 years, and we'll have some major services up in about another year. So we've done in 3 to 4 years what they're needing about 7 or 8 years to do. So, and I'm not criticizing them. I think that I've read their 20-step plan, and they have a pretty logical sequence of events happening there. It's not easy to say that you could throw away most of those steps and get it done faster. I think in the environment that they're in, there's a huge bureaucracy, and so things run by the government are not always the best way to do it. But certainly what would be good in Canada with a significant participation by federal and provincial governments is that we'd have sustained funding so that we wouldn't be caught up with having to run out and do campaigns and bingos and casinos and raffles in order to get money to run the free library service. So there would be a definite advantage to them partnering to set standards, to provide a backbone distribution network, things like that, to provide sustained funding for production, to work out issues with publishers and copyright issues. All of those kinds of things are in the public forum. But I think the best solution, in my view, is to have a partnership among all the organizations that are involved in information and library service.
What's the overall strategic vision that's driving this huge investment in getting the CNIB's library into the electronic age?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that is to look at our 5-year strategic plan that was put together not too long after I joined the library. And it was a 5-year plan that takes us from 2000 to 2005. And the title of the document, the strategic plan, is Independence. It's about choices. So when we went across the country and had focus groups and talked to clients and talked to service providers and talked to public librarians and all of the stakeholders who were involved in providing information to blind people, we kind of summed it up in the title of that document. Clients want more choices for information access in the digital age. The days of having a Braille and talking book service are gone. They want more. They want all the glitz and smoke and glitz that comes with the internet and all the digital services. And they also want independence. They want to be able to access that information independently from wherever they live, work, or go to school. So we entitled the document Independence. It's about choices, and that's what we're trying to do with the so-called IDLS, or the Integrated Digital Library System, is to implement that particular plan.
I would imagine that the majority of your members in the CNIB, your clients, are over the age of 65 or 70, with people becoming blind later in life due to things like age-related maculopathy and glaucoma, etc. People do get a bit critical of initiatives like this, saying that you're channeling a disproportionate amount of resources into younger people and forgetting the everyday difficulties that many older subscribers have, simply putting a talking book cassette into the machine.
Well, okay, there's several questions there. Number one, it's true that about 80% of our clients are in the seniors category. And when we did the research work behind the strategic plan, we talked to all age groups. And what we heard from the seniors is exactly what you said. They wanted a simpler service. Many of them, in fact, have a lot of confusion in dealing with the four-track cassette. You know, you got to flip it over twice in order to get side A and B on each of the four tracks, and they get the cassettes mixed up, and they were hard to hear, especially when the cassettes were used a lot and got old. We heard all of those messages, and certainly With the DAISY technology on the talking book side, which is part of our game plan, the initial feedback we've got with our test groups now that we're producing DAISY is, and this is coming from the seniors, is that it's a wonderful format. And some of the comments we got back were surprising to us. Like the first thing, in the plethora of comments we got back, the most prevalent comment is that I can hear the thing. It's much better sounding. A lot of these people have difficulty at later ages in hearing as well as seeing, and the clarity of the digital audio is so good for them. Many of them had never experienced CD music because they're just in that age group where they never bothered. So this is a totally new experience for them. The second comment was the fact that we can get the entire book on one CD, so once they push it in the machine, they can forget about it. And they come back the next morning and turn it on, and it remembers where they were. So the whole confusion around handling four-track cassettes is gone, and the clarity of the sound is just incredible for them. So that's coming from the seniors. On the other age groups, the working age and the students, we're actually, that is probably only about 30 to 40% of our clients, but it actually takes the most resources to serve those people. Because in the working age, there are people like you and I, Jonathan, who have a lot of demands for information and a lot of technical information. We want it fast, we want it to be varied information, and we want it to access it independently. So on that side of the equation, that's where most of our effort goes in, is to serving those clients. Getting back to the seniors again, we've also identified that the new digital services, such as the VisuNews that you mentioned, which is a web-based newspaper service, since most of those clients in the seniors group wouldn't use computers, we had to be careful to create a service that was still usable for them. So we put a telephony interface on that, and they can actually listen to the newspaper using their touch-tone phone. So in the digital age, we have an opportunity, I guess, to take these resources and make them available in many different ways. So if it's web-based, we can theoretically make access to it via telephone as well as your computer. So yes, we're very careful about paying attention to not disenfranchising our senior clients with very technical services that they can't access.
And I suppose that's what special format libraries really now are starting to come to terms with, that if they can get this information somewhere as zeros and ones, then the delivery mechanism is a separate issue.
Well, that's the concept behind the integrated digital library system. I gave a talk a few weeks ago in Glasgow, Scotland, to the International Federation of Library Associations. There was a special day there for libraries for the blind. And the title of my speech, after some deliberation, I decided the theme that I was really trying to present is that in the digital age, if we integrate all of these systems properly and bring all of these resources into a single repository, then we end up really managing data instead of managing media. For the last 60 or 70 years, we've been really forced in the library business to manage media. So when we thought of Braille, we thought of paper. We had volumes of paper sitting on shelves. And when we thought of talking books, we thought of, in the early days, vinyl discs, and et cetera. And then in the last 30 or 40 years, some variant of cassettes or audio tape. But in all cases, we were managing the media, some kind of physical inventory. In the digital age, we can really think of the data as data and decide after we've got it in the repository what is the most effective way to deliver it to the client. And it can be many and varied.
And that's the exciting thing. What sort of feedback have you received from people who are using VisuNews via the telephone? Because another of the things that you have that you hear people trotting out quite a bit is that older folks won't be able to cope that well with synthetic speech. And I know I've heard people from the NFB talking about how they've got concrete evidence that that is in fact not the case with their Newsline service. I just wondered if you had any feedback on that.
Well, the VisuNews service is very popular among the seniors, and we get all kinds of accolades, but I won't pretend that there is a problem with the synthesized voice. Most of them put up with it simply because they've lost the ability to read the newspaper, to sit down with their morning coffee and have the newspaper. Like in my case, I know when I get up every morning, the first thing my wife does is she goes to the front door and gets the newspaper out of the mailbox, and she's sitting there with her coffee reading it. I can now do the same thing by dialing in and listening to the newspaper over the telephone. or going to my computer, but I do have to listen to synthetic voice. It's the only way we can get the newspaper out at the same time as the print edition. And in fact, in some parts of Canada, they actually get the Visu News component a little bit faster than they get the equivalent in print. So, and we had, with the synthetic voice, we also had to have, cope with the English and the French issue. So we had to have a synthesizer that could handle French. So that somewhat limited our choices. And I think that we need to do a little work in that area to improve the synthetic voice. But at the present moment, that seems to be the only downside of the service. And people are so enthralled with the ability to read a newspaper in a timely fashion that they're not terribly upset about it. But it is an issue, especially for people that have some hearing difficulty.
So are you using DicTalk for the English?
No, I believe we're using Eloquence for both.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'd like to see some really good data on that subject about which speech synthesizer is considered the most intelligible. I mean, I know that there is a lot of subjectivity in that, but presumably there must be some research that's been done that indicates which synth is the most intelligible for people who aren't used to working with it.
I expect there is. I know I've talked to senior management about whether we're working on doing something about improving the synthetic voice component of Visu News, and they are aware of it. With all of the busy activities going on, things don't always get prioritized the way you'd like them to, but I know that we want to do some work in that area, and if there is research done, I'm sure that we need to track it down and see what the results were and how it might apply in our situation.
What about the idea of taking the whole newspaper and making it available as one big file, as in the model, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what they do with the Talking Newspapers Association in the United Kingdom, but that's what they do. You can download the whole newspaper, the Daily Telegraph or the Guardian, and you can take it away on your Braille note taker if you happen to have one. Is that something that you're doing or considering doing?
Well, there's no reason, I actually haven't tried it, but you could save the, just using your browser, you could save portions of the newspaper offline, so that if you were a student and needing it for background work or whatever, that sort of thing is available. We don't have quite the same component as the UK, and the reason I think is just availability. It's not necessarily that our method or their method is any better, but in Canada, to put the Visu News service together as economically as possible and with as little effort on the part of our staff as possible, because we are short-staffed. We're like any nonprofit that needs more resources than they can get. We went to a commercial vendor and actually bought that service under license. So, in other words, the best commercial packaging of newspapers that we could find is what we ended up using. So we're somewhat limited to the way they package their service.
Okay. That's an interesting concept there. So you're processing that information as supplied to you in some sort of raw data from the newspaper publishers? Is that how it works? And you're filtering that in an appropriate way?
Well, there's a company in Montreal, Canada, that actually, a commercial company that packages those newspapers. We now have 40, I think, that we have on the service across Canada. And then we have a feed through our website to their repository, and that's actually how we do it.
Okay.
So it means that we can provide the service pretty much as a portal, and our staff don't have to do anything except negotiate the contract and the licensing arrangement. So in terms of us building a whole department within the library to collect and build our own repository as newspapers, we could have never afforded to do that.
Interesting stuff. We're speaking with Jerry Chevalier of the CNIB's library, and if you would like to speak with him or ask any questions, you're welcome to give us a call at any time. The number is a New York number, area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800, and then when you're asked for a conference code, you can enter 0480-5512, thanks to spiderphone.com, 0480-5512. Well, Timothy Peters was obviously a hit at the big gala celebrations. He sounds like a very amiable young man. Can you tell us a bit about the Children's Discovery Portal?
Well, it doesn't really exist yet, as Timothy told you. What was used for that for the award presentation gala that Bill Gates was given the Louis Braille Gold Medal Award, we actually scripted out a special script that would work on the children's portal, which the design and the implementation team put together, and Timothy went through that and practiced on it so that we could show the capability, but we don't actually have it all built yet. This entire Microsoft-sponsored project, the important part of the integrated digital library system, the sort of what we call phase one, which is the digital handling system, will be built over the next year, and we're in the process of writing contracts now with the vendors and the consultants and the software suppliers this month, and our startup date is next about 4 weeks from now, mid-October, and we're hoping to put the whole thing together, including the discovery portal, over the next year.
So what is it that Microsoft is actually funding? Is it merely the so they're funding phase one, are they, of this integrated library project?
Well, we've identified in our nationwide fundraising campaign, we've identified $33 million over the next 5 years to do a number of things, to transform our operation into a digital one and to double the amount of content that we have in Braille and talking books, and to create new content, especially on the digital electronic-based services, and to accommodate growth in clients. We're going up at least 10% in clients per year, and so we have to accommodate that growth. So when you add all of that together, we identified probably about $33 million. The initial phase for this digital handling system, with Microsoft as a lead sponsor, they're putting up about $2.5 million in both cash and services to us in software.
Yeah, $33 million Canadian is a lot of money.
Well, it is. It's a big project. Probably many say it's the biggest project in CNIB's 90-year history. So we're quite proud that we're going to make this all happen. But don't forget, it's over 5 years. So it's and it's not all technology. The biggest part of that money will be spent on accommodating growth and building the content.
And when it's all done, is the idea that people who have the wherewithal will be able to download each and every talking book, for example, that you produce, if they can play it on a software-based AZ player?
That's the concept. Whether or not we'd actually do that remains to be seen. What will probably happen is the books that will be online, the audio books, would be the ones that are read the most often and get the highest turnaround. And we'd probably have offline storage on optical discs and so on for the less frequently used one. Whatever the most economic cost model is, it may not be practical to have absolutely every book that we have in our inventory online. But the idea is to have everything that the library produces in a digital repository so that it's accessible to all the production departments of the library. So for the first time, we will actually be networking all the departments together. So we've created a new unit in the library called the Digital Media Unit, which actually prepares the files for the DAISY audio, because DAISY does have an e-text component for those books that carry the e-text. And, of course, we need Braille files to produce Braille books, and we have electronic files that in their own right are standalone. So all of that, we call it the single source file concept, so that all of the information comes in from the time it's acquired from the publisher or from wherever into the repository, and then the staff work on it from there. So each and every version of the library book as it's in the production stage will be drawn down from the repository and returned to it. And at the end of the day, when the production's finished, then the e-portals that are created for the clients will be able to access those books from the repository as well. Every Braille book we produce will be up on our Visutex website, for example, so that those clients who are able to accommodate that format won't have to wait for the physical book to be delivered to them.
Because a DAISY book does take up a lot of space, doesn't it? Certainly a DAISY audio book, it'd be quite a biggie to download.
We're seeing about, on the average, they're telling me about 300 to 400 megabytes per book.
Yeah.
For most of the reference books and textbooks would be more, but leisure reading books, they're thinking about 300 to 400 megabytes.
So if you were a borrower and you wanted to download that instead of receive it in the mail, you would have to have a pretty good broadband connection.
Well, not only that, but we'd have to have pretty hefty servers if we're going to deliver that to any number of clients simultaneously. You know, so here's a pitch you could make to the federal government to build that backbone for us and to allow regional libraries across the country to plug into it. So I could go to my local library down the street and say, hey, I want this book, and they go in and find it on the CNIB website, or indeed any website. They could find it in the UK library if it's there. Download it and burn the CD on the spot for me. One of the things we're looking at, Jonathan, is we've identified a potential savings, a significant amount of money that we can save every year by doing a one-way distribution of CDs instead of having the CDs come back to us in the free postage. We just send them out one way.
Yeah, I was reading about that.
It costs us less money because we wouldn't have to have the containers to sit on the shelves. We wouldn't have to have the cost of the shelving. We wouldn't have to have the cost of the real estate office space to store the shelves in, nor the people that move the books back and forth off the shelves. If you think about it, we could do all of that in an overnight. We could run this huge program that would burn all the CDs for all the books that have been requested that day and then ship them out in little padded envelopes the next morning and then just tell the clients to keep them.
Right. So a client can build up quite a collection of talking books over the years.
Well, he could. It would afford the clients for the first time to have a private repository. And under the Copyright Act, that's not illegal. It does have some potential that we have to be careful about. And we're not saying that we're going to do this, but it certainly is an opportunity that's available for us in the digital world, and we're looking at it.
There are some who are saying that it's better to wait for newer technologies to evolve further, that the CD is not robust enough, and that, hold fire, wait a little bit longer and go to the next level.
Well, you and I probably spend more money than we should on computers and digital technology, and one of the reasons we do is because it's changing so rapidly that it's just a frightful race that you get into to stay up to date. So if you adopt that philosophy, in my opinion, it's where you're going to jump in. A few years ago, we wouldn't have had the choice of DVD, for example. Now we could say, well, we can use DVDs instead of CDs. 2 or 3 years from now, perhaps for sure in 5 years, when NLS believes that they'll be ready, the cost of flash memory may be so inexpensive that we can afford to put books on flash cards instead of on CDs. So I guess there's never a point that you can jump in and say, it's going to be stable for 10 years, let's jump in now. It'll always be changing. So we're trying on the CNIB's management philosophy is that what we do need for sure is a digital repository. So we're building that first, and the e-delivery system to the client will be whatever the most convenient technology is that's available to us at the time. But at the end of the day, whatever kind of delivery system we use, we need a digital repository. So we're going to build that first.
Do you believe some sort of solid-state, internet-aware device is an option that would allow a borrower to maybe phone the library through an IVR system, order a book, and the library could then push that book to some sort of standalone, blindness-friendly, internet-aware device?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in the design team that is sponsored by Microsoft and other consultants are not in any way limiting the e-delivery to any particular option, especially to CDs. We see the CD player now as the convenient way to replace the audio player that uses cassettes, and so that model will probably manifest itself over the next 3 or 4 years. But any kind of a device, it could be a set-top box on top of your cable TV that allows you to read books in a streaming format, or you could choose to read them online with your computer, or you could choose to use the telephone and to perhaps order the books through the catalog if we can make it interact with the telephone. We could use cell phones and talking packmates, which are coming down the pipe, accessible PDAs. Whatever is available, we believe the e-delivery system should be capable of interfacing to that technology as it becomes available.
Very exciting stuff, you know. Will you be, at this stage, though, rolling out with the Plex Store and the Victor players? Is that the intention?
We're evaluating those machines now. We have a test group across the country that's using Victor, and we're getting very good feedback on that. As you may know, there's other machines coming down the pipe. Visuate, who produces Victor here in Canada, is promising to have a very inexpensive machine very soon, and I think they're doing that to compete directly with the new machine that's coming out later this month from Telex, which is just over $200 U.S., I think, and it's a Walkman-style Daisy player with a clamshell CD-type component to it and a little tiny keypad that lets you access all the navigation features. So I think when we get the content, probably sometime next year, we've got about 6,000 books now represented in 600 titles, and we hope to have that to be about 3,000 books with 30,000 copies by next year. And at that time, we'll probably be ready to do a larger deployment of players across the country.
So you're expecting that Daisy books will be in the hands of borrowers, of some borrowers, by, what, sometime next year?
Yeah, well, we already have clients ordering them now, but it's only those very industrious clients who have already got either Daisy playback software on their computer or have purchased their own machine and are ready to go, because we don't have a lot of titles to offer. As I said, we've got about 600 titles on the catalog now that you can choose. You talked about looking at some of the catalog and other offerings that you had experimented with yesterday. If you knew the right call number letters, you could actually bring up all those Daisy books and order them now. And that will increase over time. We're both recording new Daisy books and we're converting the retrospective collection. So we expect to have about 3,000 titles in the next 9 months or so, and with multiple copies, that would represent about 30,000 books. And that will be enough of a critical mass, I think, to really do a nationwide distribution in a real way.
How are you guys getting on with the ongoing debate about what books to mark up and how much markup to put in a Daisy book? Because the Daisy production process has the potential to really slow down the rate at which books can be made available, and presumably that would ultimately mean a lessening of the number of books that are produced every year.
Well, here I'll give the federal government a little bit of credit, because we're asking precisely the same question in among the production team at the CNIB library, just what's the right kind of markup for the right kind of genre of book for the right kind of reader. And we put together a grant proposal to the federal government to do some research in this regard, and they approved the contract. So we're going to launch a formal research project and look into the kinds of navigation that Daisy provides, and do a proper research study to decide which groups and which kinds of books need which kind of markup, because you've got everything from leisure reading to textbooks, to magazines, to documents and newsletters, to poetry, to cookbooks. So we want to investigate all of those kinds of genres and try to come to some sort of standard as to how we would do the markup in those different genres.
So, for example, with a work of fiction, you may only mark up so that people can skip from chapter to chapter, but for a full textbook that might be used in, say, university setting, there could be considerably more.
That's correct, yeah. And that's likely what the research is going to indicate. But then there's all the kind of in-between. You have leisure reading at one end and full textbooks at the other end, but then you have the in-between genres, you know, your gardening books and your cookery books and your poetry and your government documents that we might do, and government policy documents, and how to do your income tax book, and the Reader's Digest magazine, and all of these. So we also want to look at all of that, because we sort of see all of that as kind of a mishmash somewhere in between, and how do we deal with the markup in those kinds of genres.
Yes, legal documents come to mind, because you're reading a constitution or something, you know, as one does when one wants a book at bedtime, and the constitution might have a clause, you know, 13.2, which references section 10.1, and to be able to jump straight back from where you are to that section 10.1, so you can think, well, gosh, what the heck did it say in section 10.1? All sorts of potentials for efficiency and information access.
That's exactly true, and the amount of labor to put all that together is considerable. So if you do one-up documents like that, if we were to do the Canadian Constitution or the Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, it's probably obvious that we would want to do that. But on an ongoing basis, when you do the monthly Reader's Digest, for example, how much do you do there?
Mm.
You see what I mean?
Yes, I do, yes.
Yeah, it's easy to take a one-up document and say, well, we've got to index this or mark it up to the highest extent possible. And we would probably do that because we wouldn't expect the Canadian Constitution to change too often. And for those bedtime readers such as yourself who wanted to be able to navigate back and forth when they should be sleeping, we want to make sure that we have as much navigation as possible.
Well, I often find that...
I'm very much looking forward to what this research is going to indicate, because we'll be talking to users of all ages when we do this research to see, well, what is it that you do when you read a cookery book or when you read the Reader's Digest magazine, and we're trying to get some sort of sense of what a standard policy should be when we do those documents on a regular basis.
Yes, and I often find that reading a good legal document at bedtime is very conducive to sleep, actually.
Well, actually, I can even fall asleep with Tom Clancy, so...
Well, there you go.
It doesn't take much once I turn it on.
Yeah, there...
That's the beauty of Daisy, I guess, is that the next morning I won't have to rewind the cassette and start all over again.
No, it's one of the good things about using Audible at the moment is that you can sort of zap back to bits that... makes sense. If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Jerry Chevalier of the CNIB's library, and if you'd like to give us a call, you're most welcome. We're having a fascinating chat about the future of their library service, and the number, if you'd like to join us, is area code 212-812-2800, and the conference code, courtesy of spiderphone.com, 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. And if you're listening to this live, in most players, you should find that information in your title bar right now. Now, is that figure of the 9 terabytes of disk space correct that I was telling you?
I thought it was 90 terabytes.
90, that's even a more amazing thing. Yeah, I wonder whether it was 9 or 90.
It'll be, if not the largest, one of the largest digital repositories in Canada. You know, I'm reading so much stuff about this, I have to actually go back, but I think it's 90. It's a huge amount of information.
So a terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes, is that right?
Right, it's a huge, it's a trillion bytes, it's a huge amount of space.
Yeah, that's just a remarkable concept to try and get your head around, 90 terabytes of disk space. You must have a really amazing backup strategy in mind for all of that stuff.
Well, that's all part of what all these experts are going to put together for us, and the plan is a very thorough one. We were very fortunate to have some inspired people that led this whole process. The executive director, Rosemary Cavanaugh, who was hired in 1992 to 2001, sort of put together the initial phase one of all of our digital library services, and she's an inspired person in terms of thinking of things in a systems point of view, even though she's a librarian. She's got a tremendous systems mind. And as people do when they get... when they do stellar work, she ended up being promoted out of the library, and she's now the vice president of CNIB's client services division, which is all client services, not just the library. So we've now hired a new executive director, and this project has tremendous appeal among the technology community, and we were very fortunate to have a lady apply for this job who comes to us from the private sector with a stellar background in systems design. She was working for the Toronto Star and redid their entire IT systems some years ago. That's a billion-dollar corporation, the biggest newspaper in Canada. And from there, she went to the TSE, the Toronto Stock Exchange, and redid all of their systems. And she's coming now to the little CNIB to do this integrated digital library for us and to function as our new executive director. And she said, you know, we can't compete with the likes of her previous employers, but she says, well, you know, I started out my life in the public library community, and I want to come back to it, and this project that you're doing is so unique in the technology community from two perspectives that I really want to be part of it, and the two perspectives were that it was a state-of-the-art technology project, but as well as that, it was one of the few endeavors left in the technology world where you can really make a change in how you do business and how you deliver service by changing your technology systems. And she was able to grasp all of that, and so we're very happy to have her aboard. So I think with her leadership and Microsoft sponsorship and the high level of technology vendors that are coming to do this project, everybody wants to be branded to this project because, as you say, it's such a huge digital repository, and the concept of a virtual library is so unique that everybody wants to be branded with this project.
One of the things that we really have to sort out as a blind community is the whole ongoing mess that is copyright for special format productions. We have a number of countries now who followed the original New Zealand model from 1994 that allow special format publishers to make copyright material available without clearing copyright with the copyright holder first. But there does seem to be some interpretation of that law within the US and Canada that prevents the free exchange of that material to members of other countries, even when those countries have similar laws. Is that something that the CNIB is concerned about?
Yes, it is. You're right. The Copyright Act, when it was changed in Canada, was there was a huge relief for us because it took away the need for us to have formal permission on every book from every publisher. And so we do have that in place. But as you say, the exchange of information across countries, which the digital age provides for us as a possibility, is somewhat frustrated by the logistics and the legality of moving that information back and forth. So we are working with that. Having said that, Jonathan, we've already negotiated with the National Library for the Blind in the UK a partnership where we are going to exchange Braille books back and forth, and we're going to merge the catalogs so that our clients and their clients will be able to search each other's catalogs. So we are putting this together, and we're currently in the stage of doing the same thing with RNIB so that we can exchange DAISY books between our two countries. So it takes more time to work out the logistics and the legalities of exchanging the information than it does to actually do the technology end of the partnership. But we're proud that we've been able to do this with the UK on the Braille side, and we're working now with RNIB because they're going full steam ahead with DAISY conversion. And they're very excited to be able to work in partnership with us so we don't produce redundant books, and that we're able to exchange books both by exchanging CDs and ultimately even doing download exchanges over the internet.
Yeah, I suppose it's the self-service type initiatives that interest many of our listeners at the moment, such as Web Braille. And what's quite interesting is that Kurzweil 1000 version 7 has just come out, and they've got an amazing feature in there where you go to the online menu and you choose an option called, I think it's search for books or something, and you can type in an author or a title, and it searches a number of resources including Bookshare, and so people from all around the world can see what they can access. But of course, if they're outside of the US, and I don't know whether Bookshare includes Canada, I think it does, but if you're outside of those regions, then you just can't have it simply by virtue of where you live, even if you have a law that's identical in content to the US and Canadian copyright law.
Well, those are issues for our governments to work on, and I guess the advocacy end of the business for CNIB is to take that forward to government and to try and make that happen. I believe that we'll have some opportunity to do that. We certainly have a good relationship with the people in the UK. We also have an incredibly good relationship in Canada here with NLS, and as a matter of fact, we buy much of our content from them. We buy their masters and then duplicate them here and make four-track cassettes out of them. And that allows us to produce more books at cheaper cost, and it allows us to concentrate on our own recording studio and producing Canadian content. So we've had these partnerships for a long time. So the challenge is, I think, to work with to continue to foster these partnerships and make sure that the faster, quicker, more independent exchange that's available in the digital world can be propagated to our clients.
Has there been some sort?
I think it'll happen.
Yeah, well, I hope so too. Has there been some sort of deal with respect to web braille access for Canada now? I think I recall reading that somewhere.
Well, we're talking with NLS about that. There's because we're part of our digital repository will be what NLS calls web braille. We call it e-braille. So that every book we produce in braille is going to be up on the website anyway, the braille files. And so if we could get braille files from other libraries, as we are now doing with NLB, if we could do it with NLS, then we're all for that. So we're constantly looking for ways to exchange that kind of information. And electronically exchanging it is just so much easier logistically than the old way of actually having to ship paper back and forth across the ocean or across the border with the U.S. We just have to do it. The digital opportunity demands that we try and work out these partnerships and deal with all the copyright issues and make sure the publishers are comfortable with information going back and forth across borders.
Oh, yeah, there's the fundamental issue, too, of Braille being, or special format material in general, in fact, being such a scarce resource, and it makes no sense to have multiple libraries around the world reproducing the same material.
Well, that's another... opportunity or benefit of the digital repository is once we start merging these catalogs and the production people are talking with the production people in other countries, then there's no need for us to redo books that the UK have already done. In fact, we don't want to. Part of sharing each other's collection would implicitly not produce the same book at each end of the ocean. Absolutely, that's a fundamental drive between working out these partnerships is not to do redundant production. I think we identified a lot of our advocacy literature uses this figure of 3 to 5% of formerly published materials worldwide are available in alternate format. That's it, only 3 to 5%. So it's such a scarce resource that it's just unthinkable that libraries for the blind would routinely produce the same book twice. What we really need to do is all get our act together and make sure that doesn't happen. And on the audio side, one of the things the DAISY Consortium has done for us, of course, is now make that technically possible because we're all using the same format for the first time. We don't have a six-track format in the UK and a four-track format in Canada and the US and a two-track format somewhere else. If most of us are using the DAISY format, then there's no reason for us to produce the same books in different countries because we can now exchange those books electronically.
Except, of course, the accent thing. And it's amazing how people are quite sensitive about that. You know, you hear Americans who... Well, some Americans actually love when they get a book, I understand, with somebody reading it who has an English accent. Other people can't understand it. And similarly with England, you know, they might turn up their nose a bit at the American accent. So that's always going to be a stumbling block, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so. I read a lot of British mysteries, and I don't mind the accent. From my wife's side, we've got relatives in Scotland. We go to UK a lot, so the accent doesn't bother me. And I think for most Canadians, even on the senior side, there's so much legacy with migration to Canada from Europe back 50 and 60 years ago that these accents are not really an issue. And in Toronto, we're blessed with, where we do most of the recording, we're blessed with a very multicultural population, and out of our incredible pool of 500 volunteers, we have people with multiple languages and with accents and with experience in different cultures. So we can match in many cases the narrator to the book that where it makes sense to do so. So I guess that's an issue, but we haven't found it to be perhaps as much of an obstacle for us here in Canada as maybe some of the American readers.
Yes, I think it might be more of an American thing. Somebody was saying the other day, my wife and I were having a conversation, and she's on an email list where this sort of thing came up, obviously not to do with blindness issues, but one of the subscribers on a list she was on was saying that she went to see the film Monty and couldn't understand hardly any of the dialogue. They're just so unused to the British accent that they found it incomprehensible, and that's apparently why so many of the US TV shows that originally came from Britain are being overdubbed with an American soundtrack.
Yeah, I was happy to see. I don't think they did it with the Harry Potter movie. I thought that might happen. So I think our American friends are starting to come around. Although I noticed on the Harry Potter movie that they named it differently in the American version.
Isn't it amazing that it's the
Philosopher's Stone? It was the
Sorcerer's Stone. Yeah, they actually there's. Well, it's interesting you say that because there's definitely some differences from what I've been able to determine between the American version of that book, which is available in Braille here, and the British edition, which my daughter's following along with in print.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's quite fascinating subject. But anyway, so that's good. One thing we haven't caught up with, and I know we've talked about it, I think, with Rosemary in the past, but for those who didn't hear that interview, is the very interesting research facilities where you've got a whole lot of databases online, and this is a happening thing right now and has been for some time, for CNIB borrowers to use. Really quite a fascinating research tool there.
Well, we call it the Reference Library Service. You know, for people, sighted people who use their public library, they're used to being able to walk into the local community library and walk up to the reference desk to the reference librarian and say, I'm going on a holiday to Mexico and I want some information about this area and the culture and the history and so on. And the librarian will dutifully pull out the right CD database, plug you down at a workstation, and you can read that. Or if you're a university student and you're doing a research project, you go to the campus library and you have a reference librarian there who can help you with the research and finding the right information. In libraries for the blind, there has never been an equivalent to that. So Rosemary, being the inspired kind of person she is, she says, well, why can't we have a reference library service here in Canada at the CNIB library? What do we really need? So they got their heads together and they created... Timothy mentioned it to you, they call it the IRC, or the Information Resource Center. But the idea is that a client can either phone up or they can email a request to the reference librarian and say, I need information on this, and I need it in this format. I've done it myself. I always ask for an email response because I want it quickly, and they can respond much quicker with email information than they can by producing Braille or audio. But they will produce those formats if the client wants. So if 73-year-old Mrs. Jones is going on holiday with her husband to Mexico and she wants some information, that's what the Resource Center is there for. She can get some information on Mexico, and she wants an audio tape, they'll produce it for her and they'll send it out, and away you go. Or if I need some information related to my work or whatever, they will find it for me. And the neat thing, Jonathan, is that I like to think that I have a little bit of expertise in finding things on the Internet, but, you know, it doesn't measure up to these professional librarians who have a career in finding resources and information. And I've even found myself that I've got frustrated trying to find some information, and I'm running out of time. I'll put together an email request and send it to our reference librarian, and I come into work the next morning, and in my email inbox she's got a couple of articles there for me, perhaps some links to other websites where I can go and find the information. And in one case that happened to me, they provided a link to a website that I had actually been to on my own, but I had missed the resource because I didn't look in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just wonderful. It allows us to use a reference library in the same way sighted people use it in their own public library.
And is there a per inquiry fee for that, or is it all just part of the free service?
Oh, no, it's all part of the free service.
Very good.
So it gets expensive if they ask for the answer in Braille.
Yeah, and is there a limit? I mean, presumably the reference librarians have to be a bit disciplined in terms of how much information they will be willing to offer.
Well, we would negotiate a little bit with the client. Like if what they're asking for is 100 or 200 pages and it's going to require somebody typing it all up and getting the Braille department to put it together, you know, it may take longer to do all of that than the client can afford to wait. So we could, in fact, in a case like that, encourage them to take electronic. It also depends on the capability of the user. I mean, if they're able to handle the electronic, fine. If they want the Braille, that's what they get, because we are very, very big on Braille, and we just can't ever discourage anybody from using Braille if that's the format of choice for them.
Do you know how many Braille readers you have at the CNIB?
I believe the figure is about 10 to 15% of our client base. So what did I say? We had 100,000. So perhaps 10 to 15,000 people across Canada. Again, that's probably not unusual with other demographics in other countries, considering that most of our clients are seniors, and people at 70 years old don't normally sit down and start learning Braille. Myself included, I've got RP, so I'm in the process of learning Braille now at a late age, but for those clients who have grown up with Braille and learned it in early school years, and it's their way of accessing information by choice, then with the digital library and with our services, we want to increase Braille, certainly not diminish it, and we're able to do that. In fact, we've been increasing over the last 3 to 5 years our Braille production in the same in a proportional manner to audio. So that's certainly a goal of the strategic plan of the digital library, is to enhance Braille output.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like you guys are on the cutting edge, and I'm rather envious of the very good library service you're running over there, so I'm pleased to be able to have a chance to catch up and look at this astoundingly exciting vision for the future, and hopefully we'll all be around when it's all complete.
Well, stay tuned. Diarized to call us back in about a year, because we're supposed to have the digital handling system done then, and the repository will be up and running, the e-portal should be working, and what you've experimented with, which is sort of generation number one of the digital library services, will be fully revamped in about 12 months' time, and should look a lot more exciting than even it does now.
Well, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you, June. I appreciate you giving up some of your Sunday evening, and we'll keep in touch on this.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks very much.
All right, we'll talk again.
You bet.
Okay, bye-bye now. That's Jerry Schrader from the CNIB's library. He's the chairman of the board of directors, and we've been talking about the digital library initiative over there, and it sounds like there are some interesting things happening. And now, as is our custom, as is our want, it's time for some open dialogue for the rest of the show. If you'd like to, can you hear? It's spring, definitely spring. I feel the hay fever season is coming. It's a beautiful spring day outside here today. Absolutely fantastic. And I always feel, or should I give you the number before I waffle on? In case you've got anything you want to talk about, you may want to discuss accents and talking books. Does it put you off if you get a talking book read by somebody with a particular kind of accent? Do you sort of really have to want to read the book, or don't accents bother you? I'd be interested in that, especially if we can get people from a number of countries talking to us about that. But whatever you'd like to talk about, it's your forum. Feel free to raise anything you like. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been here, because last week it was the big ACB Radio Interactive second birthday bash. Our number, if you'd like to participate, area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when Spiderphone asks you for a conference code, the magic number to enter, 0480-5512. 0480-5512. And I was just going to say that when I sit here on a spring day like this, I always feel like I should be studying for exams. That's how much of a traumatic effect it all had on my childhood, you see, in my young adulthood. That's the wrong line. There we go. But I always sort of felt that you start to feel the air warming up and the flowers are coming into bloom and all of those beautiful things, and then you kind of think, oh, I've got to be studying for this exam. So that's how I feel now whenever spring hits the air in September, because normally the big exams here happen in November generally, maybe late October if you're a university student. And I even have these dreams sometimes that I've got one exam left that I haven't sat yet. It's a dreadful dream, and that you've forgotten to turn up for it, and that all of the study's been wasted because there's that one last exam left to sit. This is an interesting subject. You might want to comment on that if you're feeling a bit light-hearted. May not necessarily be light-hearted, but recurring dreams. Is there something that you dream about? It keeps coming back. What a horrible thought. Now, let's go to area code 559. Good evening.
Well, hello, Jonathan.
Kia ora, how's it going?
Very good. Now, let me set the stage here. We're in Visalia, California, of course.
Yes, indeed.
I am standing in my backyard here, kind of standing on the lawn, and it's the sunset is just a couple of about an hour away, and I've got a beer in one hand, and life is good.
Well, fancy being drunk in charge of a cell phone on Blind Line.
No, one beer, Jonathan.
Oh, well,
one beer. I didn't even consume yet. One beer. I don't think we're going to be drunk on one beer.
Doesn't take much to get you blind drunk, you know?
No, it doesn't. Doesn't take you much to get... Well, doesn't take much to get blind. It's the drunk part that's a little harder.
I see.
Anyway.
Yes.
As to accents, actually, I find that the accent can add to the book. I recently read, I'm a big Dick Francis fan, and one of the Dick Francis, the latest books, I think it was the one called To the Hilt, I think, happened to take place in Scotland, and the reader, whose name I don't recall offhand, was of Scottish ancestry, obviously, and it fit. It was really very, very good.
Sometimes those really broad Scots accents are quite hard to understand, I find.
Very much so, and did take a little bit of work to understand it. Yes,
you have a drink with me, Jimmy.
It's almost as bad as a New Zealander.
Oh no, that's a very comprehensible accent, I find. I don't have any trouble with that one.
I'm sure you don't. No. You've spent a lot more time in New Zealand than I have, though.
No, yeah, that's right.
I want to do that one of these days. I do want to go visit that country, though.
Good. Well, you'd be most welcome.
Oh, absolutely, and check out the airport in Whanganui, and you know all the two or three baggage handlers there, one of whom I've talked to on ham radio already.
Checking out the airport in Whanganui would take you all of about 15 seconds. It's like
I think my first contact with Whanganui was actually in, I want to say 1975, because I was getting my first guide dog, and they happened to have a ham station at the guide dog school at the time, and I had a big beam. It was really impressive, and so I had a nice chat with a fellow in Whanganui. So I've known of Whanganui for quite a while.
There you go. It's anticipating
your
arrival.
The only time an accent would really bother me is, I think, you know, if you were trying to read about... if you're trying to read about Southerners and you had, a nice New York, New York accent there, that would be kind of hard. But I don't know. Otherwise, it would be niggling, but it wouldn't cause any problem. Lately, I've been reading my books from the PC and listening to either Triple Talk or Eloquence doing the job.
Yes,
that's kind of weird.
Yeah. I go through phases of this. It's interesting that you bring that up, because sometimes I go through a phase of getting a whole lot of books out of the print library and scanning them, and then I transfer them to my Braille notes and I read them with that and take it around with me, because it's portable, so you can take it in the bathroom and in the bedroom. Not that Paul Starch would be very keen on me taking it in the bathroom, but when you're in the middle of an exciting chapter, you just can't give it up. And it can be the source of considerable tension, which really does require you to take immediate action. But then every so often I sit down to a good audible book that's beautifully read, and I think, man, this is the life. Sometimes you read for efficiency.
I read from a company called Books on Tape.
Oh yeah.
And they do the full unabridged versions of books most of the time.
Mm.
And so I've used them. It's a pay service. And I have to admit that their readers are not nearly as good as the talking book readers.
Yes, the talking book readers talking book studios tend to have extremely high standards. I guess
they
it
really
varies
do.
A bit, but certainly here they do.
You'd think the paid services would too, but they're just not. The readers are just plain not as good. But the trade-off, of course, is that sometimes, like in the Tom Clancy books, and I was into all those, they had them out on books on tape, long before the Talking Book Library did, so that's why I use them.
And that's what I find with Audible, too. They have the New York Times bestseller list and a few other bestseller lists coming up on Audible. And when you look at the top 10, you can find almost all of them on Audible, pretty much, when they're very current. and I like that. I did read it. I'm not a huge Tom Clancy aficionado, not because I dislike him, but just because I haven't really gotten around to reading much of his. But I did read the book about, it was spooky actually, because I didn't realize it. I read the book about the 747 crashing into the White House.
Debt of Honor.
Yeah, and I thought, man, that is spooky stuff, because I wasn't prepared for it. I read it not long after the 11th of September, and it was awful. I wasn't prepared for it. Was so true to life, you know. It was.
Yeah, and I caught myself, you know, of course, I read it like 2 years ago.
Okay.
And I caught myself, you know, after September 11th, I was wondering, would Clancy have written that if he'd known that it was really going to happen, or did somebody read it? I mean, you wonder. I mean, it's just, it was unbelievable, the whole essence of the thing. And yes, as you would, so unexpected. But he had to do something, because he had to somehow get his protagonist into the White House, and he really couldn't figure out a good way to do it.
Yes, I didn't realize that he is like he's an ongoing figure that features in a whole range of Clancy books, isn't he?
Yes, he's figured on from the very beginning, actually.
Yeah.
And only once in a while has Clancy varied from him and gone into other kinds of things. But Red Storm Rising, I think, was one where that particular character was not, Jack Ryan was not included. But most of his books from the beginning had that particular character in it. But I used to like a lot more than I do now books with lots of car chasing and shooting at people and all that kind of thing. I don't know why I'd like, and I still do, but I like it. I just finished reading a book, an old Alistair MacLean book from some 20 odd years ago, and that was good because the cars they were driving in Europe were still European. They didn't have they hadn't been Toyota sized yet, and so you had, you know, little green minis running around and Mercedes and Peugeot.
Volkswagens.
Good. Well, no, that's a little too common. Opel's more.
And BWs, BMWs.
Daimler. Real honest to goodness Daimlers, not the Chrysler garbage they're putting out now.
Built to last, those cars were.
I guess. What did you guys drive in New Zealand before Toyota infiltrated the place?
We used to have subsidized, we used to have stupidly massive tariffs on imported vehicles, and so there was a very active car assembly industry in this country. So we used to have a lot of Holdens. Holden was a big brand. And Ford was big. You know, the Minis were there. But they were all New Zealand assembled, or a lot of them were. There was one place.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there was one place that sold luxury cars, and I used to do this radio gig when I was a kid. Anyway, the host who used to have me on the radio with him used to know this guy, and so I got to cruise around Auckland one day in a Rolls, which I thought was pretty damn fantastic at the time. Oh, you know, air conditioned and things, and generally in New Zealand we didn't have such things in those days.
That's interesting, because Rolls, I find the modern day Rolls, boring as all get out. The 50s and 60s Rolls much more interesting. But my brother in law back about 15 years ago now, he decided to go whole hog. He rented a Rolls for his himself and his bride, my sister, and they drove it to their reception, and it was a plain old car. I was really disappointed.
Ah, yes, it's the mystique, it's the brand, you know, it's the branding.
Whereas my Pam's cousin, they got a ride to their reception in a 57 Bentley, and I would have just killed to get inside the car, but it was raining, and we were all in our suits, and I just didn't think it was my place to go up and say, hey, guy, can I climb around your car?
Yeah, oh, why not? You should be assertive. Well, for my wife's one of her big birthdays, which I probably shouldn't name, in the interest of marital harmony.
You mean her 30th?
Well, I couldn't possibly comment. But
well, you just did. You said it was her 30th birthday. You hear that, Amanda? He told us that it was your 30th birthday.
I finished. Anyway, as I was saying, for one of her big birthdays, I hired one of these vintage Cadillacs. And that was really impressive because they fitted it out in the with this amazing sound system, and you could take the CDs of your choice in there and right in the back, and it could have like on a, it was a nice summer evening in November, and you could put the car top thing down, and they had a bottle of champagne on ice, and oh man, that's what I call.
Well, it couldn't have been too vintage, because of when I think of a vintage Cadillac, I think of the 1912 that a guy's got assembled here in Visalia, and yeah, CDs. You're lucky the horn had a bulb on it.
Aruga. Yeah.
What year was this one?
I'm talking about the 50s, I think. This.
Okay, well, 50s, even then, they didn't have CDs.
Well, no, of course they've put that in afterwards,
anyway.
Man. They put it in afterwards.
Maybe we'd better let you go before we bore everybody in ears and you have no listeners left.
Goodbye, then, and have a lovely evening with your beer.
Well, you shall have a lovely evening. You too, Jonathan. Bye-bye. And bye-bye, Amanda.
Yes, goodbye. Goodbye. There we go. That's Dave. Hey, Dave, I got the stuff. I should say that the board is free, and if you'd like to give us a call, area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when you get to the spider phone prompt asking for a PIN number, conference code, it's 04805512. That's 04805512. We're heading into a week of remembrance, of course, coming up to the anniversary of the 11th of September. And the tragic events that took place in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. Lots of people seem to remember the World Trade Center, as they should, but sometimes I feel people forget that also Washington and Pennsylvania had a tragedy that day. And you may like to comment on where you were, and before the end of the show I will tell you about some of the things that we will be doing to remember September the 11th as part of the ACB Radio Network. Hello, area code 651.
Jonathan Mosen, how you doing?
I'm not too bad for a blind man.
Yeah, ditto. I can't complain myself.
Yeah, who's this talking?
J-Dog or Joe.
Oh, right. How are you doing?
Good.
Excellent. What's on your mind this evening?
Well, actually, I got a question. I swear you should make a technology show of, like, Main Menu Part 2 or something, of people calling in, asking questions.
Son of Main Menu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Braille note, if you import a .eml file, do you know what those are?
An HTML file, did you say?
Not HTML, I said .eml.
.eml. No, I don't know what .eml is.
Yeah, well, you don't delve into file extensions like I do. Anyways, it's the thing of, like, the email. I don't even know how to explain it.
Yes.
Never mind. The heck with it. I guess I can assume that, you know, since the Braille note can read emails, I'm assuming it then can read the files of emails. Like, if you were to save an email to a floppy, and if you were to import that into the Braille note, if it could read it.
So, is this a file? What file program uses this file?
Outlook.
Okay. Well, then, no. The email on the Braille note is stored in its own proprietary database format. And what they will be coming out with in, it's scheduled for October, but I mean anything could happen. That's when Closing the Gap is, I think, October.
Closing the Gap rules.
But maybe it's not coming out then. Maybe they're going to be ready to show it then. There's a difference. But they're hoping to have at Closing the Gap a program called KeySync, and that will allow you to synchronize email and appointments between the Braille notes and Microsoft Outlook. But even then, you'd have to use that program. I don't think it's going to read those native files. But you're talking about Outlook Express, I presume, are you?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, because Outlook itself uses files with a .ost extension and PAB and stuff like that. So I haven't seen email, but I'm not an Outlook Express user.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think that I think it's quite wise. Outlook Express, I'm afraid, doesn't do it for me and never has.
Well, I haven't.
I use Microsoft Outlook instead.
Ah. Interesting. Yeah. I don't even really know what I was going to ask you. But as to where I was on the September 11th thing.
Yeah.
I was actually in school. It was around like 7:45 a.m. Central. We'd just gotten out of, It was like about the end of first hour, 8:45.
Hmm.
Central. And I'd heard something on the radio. I was like, what the heck? I just didn't really understand it. But then when I heard it, I was like, oh, wow. It's like, you know, it's like kind of hard to believe at first, but then it was, wow. I mean, it doesn't really have any effect on me. You know, because, I mean, I didn't really know anybody personally that it happened to.
And yet, there's probably a sense that one's country has been violated, though, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I got a phone call. Somebody woke me up and said to me, because I've been concerned about the Taliban for weeks. I read a lot of international news, and I had sort of detected that there was some funny stuff going on, because there was a UPI press release that not many people seem to pick up that said that bin Laden had been appointed foreign minister in the Taliban regime or something, and I thought, that's bizarre. And not long after that, this event occurred, and somebody rang me up who I'd been talking to about this and said, I see the Taliban are at it again. And I said, what are you talking about? When he told me what had happened, I thought that he'd been taking illicit substances. I just couldn't believe that it was happening, and told him not to kid around with me. And he said, well, go and turn on the television. And there it all was. It was just absolutely horrific.
Yeah, geez.
Yeah. And the dreadful thing about it was, for me, that I was on a trip that day to a far-flung part of New Zealand, so when I left, everything was pretty normal, and when I came back, the security at the airports was really tight. It was like you'd gone to a completely different country in the space of 2 days.
Oh, yes.
Hmm. Well, there you go. So you've got a Braille note, have you?
No, I don't. I want one bad.
Oh, man.
I know. Yeah, and I read the. I was psyched when I heard that you could open BRF files with that thing. You know, through the internet. I'm like, oh, cool.
Yeah, it is good. And especially, I just had a technician coming to tap me on the shoulder during the Jerry Chevalier interview, because I've been so impressed with it that I'm getting an extra network outlet installed here in the studio so that I can have the Braille note permanently connected to the LAN, because you can use it with active sync and all sorts of things through the network, which makes things a whole bunch easier, because that frees the serial port up so that you can always use it as a Braille display.
How does that whole network thing work? Like, could you connect the Ethernet cable into the Braille note, or you know, how would that work?
Yeah, you can. You have to have a network card, so that the network support is built into the Braille note, but it doesn't have a built-in network card, so you've got to get one that works with it. And this one I've got here is just a tiny wee thing, and it plugs into the compact flash slot rather than the big PCMCIA slot, and then you just plug the cable into the network outlet, and with a little bit of luck, if you've got a DHCP server that picks up the IP address dynamically, you're up and running.
DHCP, does that mean you have to use thingies like DNS to go? No,
DHCP, yes it would. No, not necessarily, because the outside world can still have a static IP address if you want to. This is just kind of dynamically assigning the internal IP addresses on your network.
I'll need somebody to help me.
If you get one, I'm sure you'll find it pretty easy to set up. It's quite a friendly beast. Well, good to hear from you, and have a brilliant week. I hope you end up with a Braille note if that's what you want.
Yeah, maybe for Christmas.
Cool.
Yeah, okay. Alrighty.
See you later. Bye. Later. Maybe we should give one away. That'd be good. This is ACB Radio Mainstream. The board is free. Area code 212-812-2800 is the number to call. Area code 212-812-2800. And the conference code, courtesy of Spiderophone, is 0480-5512. You'll get straight on if you give us a call. How about that? 0480-5512. And, yes, as I was saying, we are heading into a week of remembrance pretty much all around the world, I would say. And there's kind of this cloud hanging over us at the moment with Messrs. Blair and Bush talking up the possibility of military action on Iraq. And you just have to wonder how far the development of weapons of mass destruction has gone over there and whether we're getting into a very dangerous situation. So there's that hanging over the whole anniversary as well. You may like to recount where you were on September the 11th and how the news affected you. And there are a couple of things that we're doing on ACB Radio to remember September the 11th. One of them is that we will be replaying the GDUI program, the award-winning GDUI program, because it got the Henley Award at the ACB convention, which was pretty impressive. So we'll probably be doing that on September the 11th Universal Time. I'll come back to that, though. Area code 615.
Good evening, or actually for you it's good afternoon, for me it's good evening.
Good evening, how's it going?
Oh, just going along. My team's losing, but otherwise things are going along quite well.
Oh, well, that's all right then. Yes.
Interested in your little contest that you're running.
Are you? Good, good.
It was giving away Sea Crane radios.
Yes, it's good, isn't it? They're good company, the Sea Crane.
Yep. Art Bell loves to advertise them.
What was that?
Ever heard of Art Bell?
Oh, of course I have, yes. He's the one who thinks there's an alien in every closet.
That's about right.
Yeah.
That's about right. He loves to advertise for the Sea Crane Company.
He can tune into all the stations from Mars because it's such a powerful radio.
Yeah. Sure is. I've actually got a CC Radio Plus right here.
Oh, good.
Have you ever actually seen one of these?
No, I haven't.
It's an interesting radio. Let me describe it to you.
Okay, then.
Okay, unfortunately, I'm not too good with measurements, but I would say it's maybe, call it 6 inches tall and about, 4 inches deep from front to back.
Wow.
And maybe guessing, call it 18 inches long from left to right or right to left, take your pick.
Okay.
That may not be correct, but the best I can give you. On the top, you've got several buttons. The thing is mostly electronic. It operates with a chip. There are only three entirely mechanical controls. They are the bass and treble controls and volume control. Everything else is electronic.
And does it put out a good noise?
Oh, I would say it puts out an excellent noise.
Brilliant.
And, you know, its main thing is the AM. That's its main selling feature. It's got a very powerful AM.
And
in Nashville, I have picked up stations from Florida. I picked up one station. One time, I picked up several stations from New York City. I picked up a station from Boston. And as far west as Denver, Colorado.
And you know what the trouble with a lot of AM radios is, apart from their poor signal strength, is that they sound horrible. And I understand that the Sea Crane CC Radio Plus sounds very nice on AM. It's sort of wide band sounding.
No, unfortunately, it does not have a wide band sound on it. I wish it did, but it does not. I've got a wide band stereo radio, so I can easily compare the two.
Okay.
It does have pretty decent sound for talk, but not all that great for music.
Okay.
Now, it has five memories on it. The five memory buttons are across the top. And what's interesting is that they have tactile print digits on the memory buttons. So if you can read print, you can easily determine which memory button is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's got four bands in order. They are FM, AM, VHF television, and no weather radio. In case of no weather radio, it has seven channels ranging from 160, 162.40 to 162.55 megahertz. Yeah, this is the band for no weather radio. 25 megahertz increments. Megahertz, I should say. So, 40, 425, 450, 475, 500, 525, 550, 1. Yep. Let me see if I can... Let's see.
Mostly sunny.
Give you a little bit of the weather radio here.
Taking a look at the extended forecast. For Thursday, mostly clear. Lows in the middle 50s. Highs around 80. For Friday, partly cloudy. Lows in the upper 50s. Highs around 80. For Saturday, partly cloudy. Lows around 60. Highs in the lower 80s. And for Sunday, considerable cloudiness. Chance of thunderstorms. Lows in the lower 60s. Highs in the lower 80s.
Now that, you might be interested to know, is one of their, shall we say, human synthetic voices. They call him Craig. What that is someone digitized all the phonemes used in the English language, and the computer program put them together and created this version of synthetic speech for NOAA Weather Radio. You will note that its speech is not quite as free-flowing as, say, Deck Talk. It has some interesting quirks. For example, at least around here, instead of saying the word normal, it will say either normal or normal. They can't seem to get it to say normal, no matter what phonetics they try. I just learned that little item a few days ago from the meteorologist in charge.
And, you know, for people who aren't aware of this competition, the ACB Radio Interactive is giving away CC radios. Last week we gave away a Sanyin SR3, and this week it's a Sanyin SR2, and people go into the draw once they win one of those to get the CC Radio Plus, which Michael is playing with at the moment. Not the particular one that we're giving away, because we wouldn't want to give it to you after Michael has been playing with it.
Right.
No.
It's just a copy of it.
Yeah.
Now, this also has a clock, alarm clock, and event timer.
Is that accessible?
Sort of. You can set the clock using the arrow keys, which have tactile markings for up and down. Unfortunately, you are not able to read the clock. In the case of the alarm clock and the program timer, it does double beep when you turn it on and single beep when you turn it off, so that you can at least know when you have it on or off, and you can set it with the arrow keys. You definitely do need the cassette instructions to tell you how to do it, since otherwise you wouldn't have a clue.
And we are giving away the cassette as well, by the way.
Yep. Anyone ordering the radio does have to ask for the cassette instructions specifically, because they will not come automatically.
Right.
Now, the scanner part, the arrow keys on the, let's take with the AM band here, will move by 10 kilohertz increments, so it readily moves from station to station. There is a separate electronic tuning knob which moves backward and forward by 1 kilohertz increments, so you can really fine tune things. And in a review I heard of this along with similar radios on a cassette magazine, they actually were able from Boston to pick up a British station at an offbeat frequency relative to U.S. frequencies.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it possible to set that to 9 kilohertz spacing if you were using it outside the U.S.?
No. What you would have to do is to move backward or forward 10 kilohertz and then turn your knob up or down one click.
Right.
Now, it does click for each increment. So you don't have to guess that you're moving by 1 kilohertz increments. It's a nice little click.
Hmm.
You don't hear it, but you can feel it in the knob. Now, there's also a switch on here, which, when it's in the up position, locks all the electronic controls. This will allow you to walk around with the radio without accidentally hitting a button and changing a setting or turning on or off the radio.
Right, that's a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Now, the weather band also comes with the weather alarm feature. The no-weather radio stations in this country have two different alarms that they use. One is a data feed that they send out for the new radios, which I have, called a same radio. And they also put out a long weather alert tone. This works for the old-style weather radios and for the CC Radio Plus. It will pick up the tone, and then automatically the radio will come on, if you have it set to do this, and play for 10 minutes, then switch off. The settings are nothing, a light, which is separate and you wouldn't want because you can't see it, tone, tone and light, and then back to nothing. Now, the button that does this, you hold it down to change the settings, and it does beep for the time when you change your settings. And it has different beats so you know which one you're going to, which is quite handy.
Yeah.
Now, it does come with a pair of antenna screws in the back so that if you wanted to, you could hook up an external antenna, though it does come with a built-in AM antenna and a telescoping antenna for your FM and TV and your no-weather radio. It also comes with two jacks on the back. One is for the light I already described, and the other jack is so you can hook up a solar panel power pack available from Sea Crane. This will allow you to run your radio off of solar power. Now, it can either come with a rechargeable battery pack, which will allow you to play the radio at night, or not, as you choose. It also has three jacks on the right-hand side in the back. The bottom jack is for audio output, controllable by your input source's amplifier. That is, the volume control of this radio does not affect the output jack.
Yep.
The middle jack is for a timer, which is available from Sea Crane. You plug it in one end into the radio and the other end into a voice-actuated tape recorder. Available from Sea Crane. Everything's available from Sea Crane. And this will allow you to turn on and off the radio at specific times. You have to have it already set to the frequency you want, but it will let you turn on and off the radio. And the top jack is for audio input. This will allow you to hook up an external audio source to your Sea Crane radio and listen to it that way. It is interesting to note that the cassette instructions specifically reference hooking up your talking book machine to the Sea Crane.
I was just going to say, yeah, that'd be good, wouldn't it?
Which I thought was quite interesting.
Hmm.
The radio takes 4 D-cell batteries. I tell you, it's a pretty hefty radio. The handle is quite built in. It is non-adjustable, but it is readily usable by anybody. And it is just an all-around fantastic radio.
Well, good. I hope that that will entice people to enter the competition on ACB Radio Interactive.
And it also comes with a sleep timer.
Ooh.
You can have it set to go off in either 90, 60, 30, or 15 minutes. And that is semi-accessible. It's a strange way of doing it, but it does sort of work.
Cool.
Both the audio output jack and the earphone jack will provide stereo audio for your FM if you hook it up either to your headphones or to your stereo system. The radio itself only comes with one speaker, so there's no stereo there. But if you want stereo FM, plug in a patch cord to your earphone jack or the audio output, and voila!
Voila!
We have stereo.
That's French, you know. Well, that's...
The power cord is detachable from the radio.
Hmm. That's good. That's like a little main menu review. Live on Blind Line.
Yep, you cannot plug the power cord in wrong. It will only go in one way.
Cool. Well, thank you for that, because now people know exactly what they would be getting if they win this wonderful grand prize at the end of September.
Yeah, and it is it is a $159 value, ladies and gentlemen, and I suggest you go after it with gusto.
Hey, thank you very much, Michael. I really appreciate that.
And I shall... Well, what do you have for main menu this week?
Oh, you don't really expect me to tell you that, do you?
Of course I do.
Let me see. We are going...
How can you see?
We're going to be talking to Stephen Baum about and demonstrating Kurzweil 1000 version 7 and some of the groovy new features in there. And apart from that, we've got quite a few contributions that are sitting here waiting to go on, so it really just depends what fits. I've had a lot of demand for please, please do part two of the Broadcasting on the Internet series, but I don't know whether we're going to be able to do that this week or not, but I will see if I can manage it. It's all pretty fluid right now. It all depends on... See, when you've got all these contributions sitting here waiting, you just have to see what best fits into a two-hour time frame.
Especially with a long review of the Kurzweil.
Well, it might not be that long. I mean, we've got the interview, and then there's just a few new things I want to show off, but it probably won't be that long.
And you never know.
Well, I'm going now, because my network... I had to send my poor network man away, so hopefully he's about to come back.
Well,
yes.
Just have him come back 5 minutes after the hour, and you should be all ready to go.
Beautiful. Well, nice to hear from you, and thank you for that comprehensive explanation of the CC Radio Plus.
You're welcome, and I shall talk with you next time.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
And just to tell you that if you would like to win that, and it sounds like a great radio to win, the way we're doing this is that you tune into ACB Radio Interactive, and every day there is a song snippet that we play. The idea is to send in the artist and the title. If you don't know one, just send in the one that you do know. So if you know who's singing it but you don't know what it's called, that's fine, and vice versa. But you do have to listen every day for that week, because at the end of the week, and we've got a new week's competition starting today and ending at the end of Sunday UTC, we tally up the number of points. Each contestant gets a correct point for every artist they get right, and a correct point for every title they get right, that they email to contest@acbradio.org. And when you do email that, don't forget to give us your state and telephone number, or country and telephone number. It's the phone number that's the key. Because if you are the winner for the week, you'll get a smaller prize, which is still worthwhile, giving away a Sanjin radio this week. And we want to phone you up and tell you that you've won it, you see. And that's how it works. Now, just before I go, as I said, we're going to be replaying the GDUI program. Isn't it terrible when your mind goes blank? Canine Connections from GDUI that was a special for September the 11th and won all sorts of praise, including the Vernon... No, it wasn't the Vernon Henley Award, was it? I think that went to Arthur. But it was an award anyway at the ACB convention. And so we'll be playing it again. That will be on September the 11th UTC, so it means that main menu will run a bit less than it normally does, and we will start playing that at 0 hours UTC on September the 11th, which is actually still the 10th in the US, but it will play for a 24-hour period, so it will play throughout most of September the 11th alongside main menu. Now, also, on ACB Radio Interactive, at 1 UTC on September the 12th, which is still the 11th of September in the United States, at 9 Eastern and 6 Pacific, Steve Bauer will be doing a two-hour remembrance special in which he'll be featuring the words and the music of September the 11th. Steve will do a wonderful job of this, and it will be a fitting, appropriate tribute to those who lost their lives, to those who saved lives, and in some cases lost their own in the process. So that's how we are remembering September the 11th on the ACB Radio family of stations. Thanks for your company. I won't be here next week for Blind Line, but we'll try and have something interesting for you. And John Wiedlich is away tomorrow, so we will be featuring the Soundings program from the UK, followed by Phil Parr and Friends with the highly excellent Blind Handyman show. Thanks for your company. We'll catch up with you soon.